When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 153. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading down to Llanefil in Mid Wales to talk to farmer Matt Launder. Matt, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you very much. I'm sat on a beautiful side of the hill. I'm looking across over at Llasin Farm because I don't look at my own. and it's lovely and green, and you would have thought it's like a nice June morning, but no, it's lovely, really happy.
Yeah, it's nice to be getting a nice end to the year after a difficult season, is it? No doubt you've got an abundance of grass down there, have you?
I have, not as much as my neighbours, but yeah, that is, we have got stacks of grass. That's one thing we don't struggle for here is moisture.
Yeah, and I guess being down there where you are, for people who don't know that part of the world or people who might be in other countries and not realise, fairly... maybe not remote, but you know, you're quite a long way from any major population centres. So all the chaos and craziness that's happening in the rest of the world must feel a long way away at the moment, does it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I think we're about realistically with traffic about half an hour away from our nearest supermarket, probably. If you caned it, maybe you'd probably get there a bit quicker. So you don't, like, when the roads are a little bit busy, like there's more than four cars or whatever, you do think, wow, where's all this traffic come from? what are all these people doing? But you can also, you can get quite isolated in the way that, you know, I haven't left Llanefil properly, I don't think, like, you know, in smart clothes and clean clothes since March.
Wow.
So you can quite easily just make this your epicenter, your world. You don't need to go anywhere else. But yeah, it's all a million miles away from me.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people down there won't ever leave. They're out of choice, will they?
No, why would they? They're guarding it. If they left, someone else might take their place.
Exactly. Today we'll be finding out what a posh ginger-haired Englishman is doing in the mountains of Mid Wales. So let's get into your background a bit. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Stroud in Gloucestershire, and then I grew up in Cheltenham and Gloucester, really. So that's probably why my accent yo-yos between Gloucestershire and maybe pompous arsehole Cheltenham. I can say that because I'm from Cheltenham. And then a little bit of Llanefil. So that's where I grew up.
Your dad was a Royal Marine.
He was a Royal Marine. He joined the Marines when he was 18. Wow. He is from, so my family originates from Carlisle, Carlisle, Whitehaven. Okay. And Skelwith and things like that up in Cumbria. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to, back when he was that age, he wanted to become a farm vet. He was desperate to be a farm vet. And we're not from any farming stock whatsoever. He just really wanted to be outdoors and loved animals.
Yeah.
So he wanted to do that. But it was from an era, his dad was a bit of a war hero. And it was that era, his dad was a policeman. He was like, no, you must get a job in an office. That means, mm-hmm. that shows success. Mm-hmm. So he went and worked for a lawyer's, I believe. And a very, very clever man. Really clever man. You know, he could have gone to, I believe, Cambridge or Oxford for writing and things like that. He's a fantastically clever man. And he went, no, I can't miss. So he rebelled. He spent his whole life rebelling, basically. So at 18, he wanted to find the hardest thing he could possibly do. So he joined the Marines. And then once he got through the Marines, he kept, the way he tells it, he said to himself, well, hang on, if I've managed to do it, it can't be that hard, you know, because that's his mentality. So he went into the Special Forces.
Okay.
And then he's like, well, I've done that now. And then he went into the Metropolitan Police, and, you know, then his career led on, really, to, the way he used to train, he used to fell run, he used to, like, the man was hard as nails, in my mind, as everyone's father is. They're a hero, aren't they? And
did you ever consider joining the Marines as well?
I did. So my brother was a Royal Marine too, and he had a 12 or 13 year career or something in the Marines. And so, yeah, at 16, I was like, right, I'm going to go one or two ways here. I'm either going to be a Marine or I'm going to be a rugby player, because everyone has that thing. And yeah. So at 16, I was at careers fair at school, and I was like, right, okay. I went to the Marine, the Marine desk or whatever it was. Yeah. And they were like, look, we can fast track you as your brothers are still serving. We're doing this. I was like, oh, great. Okay. So I took the form home, and I took it. I didn't say anything to anyone for a while, but my brother found it, and he was like, right, well, yeah, this is a stupid idea. You don't want to do this. Because you want to go and get your own personality and find out what you want to do in life before you go and join the Marines.
Okay.
And, you know, and I was pretty, pretty keen, because obviously I played Call of Duty, and that's how war is, I believe, Will. So I thought I could just reboot when I got shot.
Yeah.
So he found out and he said, no, let's just have a go. Wait till you're 23 is what he said.
Okay.
Look, he said, look, you're playing, you know, you want to play rugby, or you want to, I always wanted to farm as well. So why don't you try doing those things? And at 20, 23, you've got your own personality. You've built your image, your MO of who you want to be. And then, you know, they can't take that from you. Mm. So I got to 23 and I was too buggered. I couldn't pass a medical anyway. So
thanks, bro.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, good mate.
Okay. So obviously then in the family, there's a strong work ethic and sense of discipline though. Do you think you have that as well?
Yeah. So my mum she's like a computer, she's got like 3 degrees, and she's, you know, she's a pioneer in what she does. She's an equine and human osteopath and rehabilitation specialist and she works with like Olympic show jumping horses and the dressage teams and does all sorts of wonderful things like that. And, you know, she from a little village in Cumbria, she was quite a pioneer, went to, you know, she did her last degree when she was 45, when she had four kids. And so, you know, the work ethic in our family, it is there. We've always been highly driven.
Yeah.
Now did the discipline, however, now, like I'm not afraid to say it. It's one of my many failings is I'm a lazy bastard. I try and micromanage my laziness.
Yeah.
So I know I am lazy. So I try and put things into place so I cannot be lazy.
Yeah.
So I try and do like a stop to fix protocol. So if I walk past them, they just go like, well, let's just fix it now. Although half the brain's like, come on, let's just go and do something else. So we're all guilty in the family of probably like starting something and then carrying on, moving on to the next shiny object. Mm-hmm. Mum is very much like, she like sits down and like she'll sit down and she'll just keep going. Not, you know, if it's a failing thing, she won't. But I mean, like, she knows she's got massive drive. So we're all hugely driven, and it does make for some bickering, because all of our ambitions are over, like folding over. You know, because I've got three siblings, and we're all massively driven. So we go like hell, but not always in the right direction.
So growing up around horses, were you one of those kids who grew up sort of half on horseback, half on foot?
If you're asking if I ever wore jobbers, Will, then yes, once upon a time.
I am, and I want you to send me a picture so I can put it as the show.
Because I look like someone's badly photocopied Ed Sheeran into a pair of jobbers. He's far better looking than I am. So we always had, we didn't have the easiest, we had a very, bloody, really good childhood, but it was quite a contrast. Like on one side, like a few economic downturns reasons, we lived in where we lived, but then like mum always managed to hang on.
Yeah.
Fair play to her, like through everything, to a few horses. So that's been her passion. She's always bred. So I think she's got her first horse when she was 13 or something.
Wow.
And but it had to be like her. She's from a family where her dad was like, "Well, it could only come here if it could pull logs on the fell." It has to work, and then you can have it. We've always had them. So I kind of grew up like jumping horses and doing all sorts of stupid things. You know, like I remember I wanted to be a cowboy when I was really young, so they got me a cowboy saddle for a pony, and you know, and it sounds like a very privileged life, but it was, you know, mum and dad worked their behind off. So we could, you know, so we would basically the struggles in our lives would never be present to us as kids. It would always stop at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dad was very poorly, and so mum had to basically toe the line for that while. So I'm just trying to tell everyone that I wasn't a complete privileged kid, because you said a pot. So everyone's now imagining me like being on a polo yard. I've never played polo, and I used to get picked up from school in an old Peugeot. We did used to have horses, and we've always had them. But I think what it does, it gives you, it probably prepares you to go into farming. One, because you know how you want your farm to be, and not how a horse makes it. But they're a strange character. I think a horse.
Mm.
They're not like any farm animal.
Okay.
And so I think, they're quite present, if you know what I mean. They're sentient beings, aren't they? They are very much, they've got their own personalities as individuals. And then I know farm animals do and so on, but you can really single out horses.
So do you think that early association with horses is what sparked your interest in looking after animals generally?
Yes, I think so. I've always, I remember for as long as I can remember, I've been desperate to be a farmer. I've always wanted to be. So my carpet farm was something serious, something to be enviable. I had it all going on. I had arable, we had dairy, we had mega dairies before mega dairies were a thing. I was doing it all. And so I was desperate to be a farmer. Looking after the horses and stuff, want to breed them as well. And see how your hard work and bring in new generations, and you can, I don't know, improve aspects or whatever. I've always been really fascinated by the genetics and stuff. So yeah. So from a young age, I could play with the toy farms, and then when I'd have to go and they were going to the horses or whatever, and I'd have to just amuse myself. I'd get empty barrels and pretend they were cows. What a sad and lonely childhood. Start doing stuff with those and stuff. Yeah. So they've always, I've always just had this want to have animals.
So how did you go from there to actually getting into farming?
I was about 7 or 8, and I did some work on a farm or something, and our neighbours. So we lived in a really urban area, but we rented land in Eldersfield, which is very rural, really rural. Just imagine, the beautiful red brick farm buildings, and it was really rural. So we rented 18 acres there, and it started off with chickens, and then selling eggs, and then that, I believe, went to goats. And I would then used to buy goats, and I'd breed them and I'd rear them, and then I'd used to sell them to my teachers at school.
Oh, okay.
As butchered goats, because it's obviously very, it's a decent meat. And then on my, I was working at a farm, every hour I could, I'd go and work for dairy farms after school. I wanted to be a dairy farmer at one point, but then I worked how early you have to get up.
That is the trouble with dairy farms.
I'm not that ambitious. Worked on dairy farms and anything I could, if I could just go and sit in a tractor with someone for a day, that'd be all I'd talk about for weeks. I'd probably really boring to my mum. And then eventually when I was about 13, after working on a sheep farm for a while, our neighbour, he was a cracking bloke. He was an oddball, but he was a brilliant guy. My mum bought me, and my mum and my sister managed to buy me 6 Jacob ewe lambs.
Okay.
And so that's how it started, really. So, yeah, so I had those 6, and I treated those 6 like an empire. I was absolute farmer thick sheep, That's all I spoke about. I was so boring. No wonder I had to have animals. Kept those, and then when they became yearlings, I got given a Jacob tup, and then we started breeding Jacobs, really. And then my ambition was always to be a farmer. I didn't know how I was going to get there. I didn't know when I was going to get there, but I always wanted to be one. Class myself as a farmer so bred them up, and then we started messing about with showing and stuff. And then, we started showing Jacobs, and then, then we started crossing the Jacobs with Texels and working out that actually they were really good meat. So we then started selling meat boxes. And then, with the money, you'd buy, I'd either buy a new pair of rubber boots so I had the flashiest wheels on the pitch, or I would.
What colour boots did you used to wear?
Oh, I was rocking it, mate. I was rocking it the orange, which you shouldn't do when I'm ginger. I had purple boots with my initials on because I'm an arsehole. All sorts of colours. Basically, the brighter the colour, the better. Wow. I thought.
And what position do you used to play rugby? You'd clearly be a forward.
What are you trying to say?
You're a big lad.
BMI given away. I started life in the front row, believe it or not, when I was really young.
Yeah.
Because, just farming lads, isn't it? Like, you're outside, you're being strong. So I had mong strength. And then I was really strong. And then I went from there to back row.
Okay.
And then I lived the rest of my life at 6 or 8.
6 or 8, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. That's brave, wearing flashy boots in the forwards. You know, it's usually for poncy wingers like me with the collars up and trying to keep your
shorts
clean.
Were you a winger back in the day, were you?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
I say back in the day like you're an old man, Will. I do apologise.
I'm pretty old.
No, not that old. Near start of your career.
Yeah, okay. So, well, that, I mean, let's talk about new entrants in general. Now, it seems to me that this is something we've been talking about for years in farming, and we're often quite self-critical about it as an industry. And yet, there are what seems to me to be, to be an increasing number of new entrants. I mean, you've just talked about how you forged your own path in, and there are lots of other similar stories. So are we too hard on ourselves as an industry, or do you think we could be doing a lot better?
I do agree. I think there's a turning of the tide at the minute. And I think with the help of social media, we're seeing an absolute surge of great, young, ambitious new entrant farmers. And they're really showing us how it's done. Mm. But I don't know. It's a difficult one because there's pockets of our industry where, I'm going to speak plainly, but there's that old boy mentality.
Yes.
Right, which is, I'm going to hang on to the checkbook until they turn the life support machine off.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, my son or daughter can have it, but really they've got probably not that much time left to make their own stamp on the world either.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be more opportunities, but I do agree that there is, you know, there's a fantastic resurgence. Like, look at the if you just look on, you can look on Twitter for 20 minutes and you can just see these great people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see, but then you can also see farmers' sons and daughters, when they get given the opportunity at the right time, the amazing things that they can do too.
Yeah.
You know, I've just come back from Llea Jones in North Wales. I just came back. We were up there on Saturday, and what a fantastic operation he's running with his wife.
Yeah.
You know, he said that, you know, he started with the tenanted farm at 19, and now he's got 5 or 6 businesses. And they're all completely diverse, and he says that, you know, you want to be making money when you're asleep. That's when you're profitable. But there needs to be. I think there just needs to be an emphasis on the next generation in general, regardless of where they come from. I really don't think that we need to go, right, okay, well, if they're new, you know, we don't need to say that they're new entrants or whatever. I think we're just, the next generation opportunities have to be given, because that's how we're going to drive our industry on.
Yeah.
We're going to move forward. It's the next generation, isn't it? Regardless of where they come from. But I do say that the fresh blood coming into the industry is fantastic. I don't think it's getting to a point now where, although it helps, I don't think you do need to be from agriculture to be a fantastic farmer.
No, I definitely agree. And I think back to when I was sort of in school in the 90s. And then even when I went to university to help Radham study agriculture, it was agriculture was seen sort of in the press as a bit of I don't know about a dying industry, but it certainly wasn't cool. You know, there wasn't many people signing up to study it. There was a lot of farmers' children who were just moving away from farming altogether. But it does. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned social media, and that's a good example. Farming does seem to be cool again, doesn't it? You know, you look from the outside, people have never been as interested in food production as they are now, are they? And people and maybe even coronavirus has forced people to reevaluate a bit their lives and what they want to do. And
That's it. Like I said, I remember even when I was at college, the rugby lot never mixed with the farming lot.
Yeah.
And it was just a bit of, you just didn't really, you know, and it wasn't like, it was a run of the mill joke that, oh, you don't tell them that you're a farmer, do you? Well, at that point, I wasn't a farmer, you know, I had about 150 ewes. So it wasn't, I didn't class, but that's my own thing. I didn't class because I'm so ambitious, I didn't class myself as a farmer, although I was, you know, on the side farming. But yeah, you never spoke about it. If you went out in Cheltenham, you went to the bar and you were trying to talk to a girl, you didn't go, well, I'm a farmer, you know. Because they'd be like, all right, Berg. Whereas now, you're right. Farm is cool. Farming is, excuse the phrase, it's on message, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
But leading back, I think that has got so much to do with another burst of generation coming through. Because, you know, I always stand by that we should definitely remember and learn from people before us, but we always have to be driving forward as well.
Yeah. I mean, the technology helps that, doesn't it? I mean, because the fourth agricultural revolution, which we're very much in the midst of now, is something that is also going to attract young people as well, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. The fact that, you know, you can draft all these ewes on a computer, it means that you don't have to do it yourself. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I think the fact that, you know, we're embracing technology, but I think agriculture through the years, if you listening to what James Redbacks was saying, his grandfather ran a rotational system.
Yeah.
At one with nature. Well, aren't we all now going back to rotational systems? Yes. So that's why I say that I think we should always learn from those guys. But can we take what they have done and what they have taught and maybe just mechanize it and make it technological so that it can be running 24/7 or so it can be more efficient? Because farms, it appears, are becoming more and more one-man operations. I don't know if you agree with that or not. Like our system very much is a one-man operation and it relies on the one-man operation.
It's interesting you say that. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, is there? But apart from maybe Brexit, and I don't want to sort of dwell on Brexit and the sort of rights and wrongs of it, but it is going to create a seismic change potentially in British farming with the new British agricultural policy coming in as we move away from the EU. And one thing, when I speak to a lot of young farmers, they were quite pro-Brexit because they felt that the old system stopped young people getting in. As you said, it kind of kept the older generation in who were kind of clinging on. Do you go along with that? Do you think there are opportunities ahead from Brexit or not?
Are you trying to make me use the phrase slipper farmer? are you trying to throw me under another bus?
You're going to have to explain what slipper farmer means now you've said it.
it's a term that I didn't come up with, but it's a term that I've used. Slipper farmer is maybe someone, I'm going to try not to Michael Gove you now. It may be someone who has a big farm, claims a subsidy, but does just enough basically so the subsidy, they continue to get the subsidy. So there's a certain criteria, isn't there? So that's probably a slipper farmer, you know, the payment comes in and then that's it, which it's a massive decrease. There's less and less of them now because it's not sustainable. Do I agree with the young people on Brexit? I'll be ballsy now and say, I stupidly probably now, I did voted out because I don't really get much of a single farm payment and I've been messed about by all of my landlords. There are some cracking landlords out there and I've had some brilliant ones and I've probably annoyed them. But they're on the whole, the bigger the property I was renting, the more slipper farmery they became. Yeah. So I was, because there was so much lack of information for me, and since involving myself with the NFU, they have educated me. Mm. But I was just always on the idea that, well, hang on, if we do, like, change is never bad.
Yeah.
And I think if there's change, then there's an opportunity for the rest of us to have a go. If there's, you know, maybe if the subsidy system was changed, then there's an opportunity for the rest of us if it was on, you know, put on output. And so us guys and girls who were doing, you know, actually producing something from our landscape, well, they should really be getting the support.
So how did you go from having 150 ewes to getting your own farm?
I sold my soul to the HSBC. By the time I did my GCSEs, it was about 150 U's, roughly. And that's probably why my GCSEs are the way they are. And then I got to about 18. I finished college. I tore my knee apart in a rugby game for an Irish exile, believe it or not. I don't know if there's much of an Irish tie, but it was desperation. No one else would have me, so I decided to go there. So I thought, right, okay, well, I'm not going to make it to rugby play. I'm not good enough. And realistically, I'm not committed enough. So I've got to look at my options. And I didn't want to be, as I say, I wanted to try farming before I tried the Royal Marines, really, which is very, obviously, a massively lucky option. So, yeah, so I had 150-odd ewes and various other things going on. And I was working on a farm in Gloucester, a couple of farms, and back for, you know, £5 an hour. Big days. They wouldn't. So right now, I'm like, well, that'd be the dream if you could pay someone £5 an hour. But, yeah, but it was worth it. You know, I'd work there for free just to get the education.
Yeah.
Because that's what it's all about. You know, experiences are expensive, aren't they? But that is education. So yeah, so did that. And then like my dad, so as I say, my dad's lived abroad my whole life pretty well. He worked and lived in Africa, parts of Africa, basically where the most shooting goes on. He'd go and work. So I think he just didn't like us. That's what it was. he left all that to mum and then came back when we were all grown up. Sounds like a good option, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes. With your homeschooling.
Yeah. That, I don't think. Yeah.
So he wanted to come home. So his retirement was like 10 years off.
Okay.
And so he was like, right, okay, well, so we lived in rented accommodation and we thought, right, well, due to, as I say, economic downturn back in the day when he got ill and so on. So we were in rented accommodation. So we were like, right, well, look, why don't we have a look? Why don't we try? You know, now I was too young to get a mortgage on my own. So I'm extremely lucky and extremely privileged that I got that. So I am one of the clauses on the mortgage. So I had to come in with them, but they had to come in with me. So we all had a bit of the pie. So, sure. So Dad wanted somewhere to retire, and Mum was like, right, well, you know, Mum wanted a place to live as well. So I said, look, okay, tell you what, if I farm the ground, you guys have the house and the barns, and you, Mum, you can do what you want to do, and then Dad, you can do what you can do, and I'll do what I can do. It turns out you can't do that on 74 acres, because everyone gets about 10 acres each.
Yes.
So that's what we did. So, you know, we tried a lot of banks and stuff, and then went to AMC, which... Yeah, and they helped us, and so we looked at some farms in Wales, and we stumbled across this farm in Llanerfel called Golcha, and it was beautiful views, and it was, you know, wasn't done, it's not finished by any means. It was a start. It was a white Welsh, beautiful white Welsh stone house, mm-hmm. and some old buildings, and apart from that, that's all it was. So we moved here and. We went, right, okay, well, we've got to start. You know, bear in mind, I was 18 at this point, so I still thought Suffolks on a mountain were a good idea. Like, I moved here and I knew nothing. I still don't know very much now, but
to be fair, Matt, who does know much at 18? I mean, I certainly didn't know my ass from my elbow at that age. So
I know, but because I my picture of farming was always out of, like, the farming papers. So you'll see this picture. This is what's ruined me. I see the picture of these beautiful farms and you work, you find out how successful they are and stuff like that. And I got there and I was like, well, this is going to be a showroom farm in 2 minutes. I didn't know it took generations. so we started converting it, basically. We put up buildings, which for some reason now the system I run now is all grass based, so it's completely backwards that the first thing I invested in was buildings. But that shows how stupid I was and how naive I was. So we put buildings up, we started to turn it into a farm, what we regarded as a farm, which might not be what everyone else does, but yeah, we put some sheds up, we put a yard, you know, we took back which was a wet, boggy field, basically, and stoned that and put it into a yard, and so it started from there, really. And then we had our farm, and then
did you get lots of help from neighbours and the wider industry? Were people around the area encouraging?
Yeah. Oh, do you know what? You could not. I. So some people say you move to Llanerfel and they're like, oh well, you're a bit English to do that, aren't you? but what a what a group of people. You know, there are some, like with everywhere, there's some good people, there's some bad people, but like, what a fantastic bunch of people. So the people who moved out of the farm originally, it was, she was lovely. They, you know, they did little things like they had the fires, they had all the wood baskets all filled up, and they wrote A4 pieces of paper of who to call and who, these are the people. And, you know, and there was, we had to get used to that sense of community. So in Gloucester, if someone turns up at the farm unannounced, you're usually like, what are you doing? What are you trying to sell me? Or what have I done wrong?
Yeah.
Whereas here, I'm just like, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I just want to just come and introduce myself, and we've heard you moved to the area. And there were some cracking rumours going around that I moved here with my 55-year-old, 60-year-old wife, and that my dad was James Bond.
That is the most Welsh rural community thing.
Isn't it, Jess? And then amazing. They started to meet me, and they were like, oh no, that's just his mum. my dad's not James Bond. So, but they were fantastic. You know, like there are, you know, Richard Tudor was a great guy. He came over I think he really shaped the way that I want to be as a farmer and the way that I want to drive forward. But, you know, he introduces the people, and then everyone introduced everyone to someone, you know, and then a good friend of mine, he basically rocked up. For 6 months, I was just kind of hiding on this hillside, not knowing how to like introduce myself really to like, because I was very, I'm very comfortable with let's say grown-ups, because maybe my siblings are so much older than me and so on. So I was very comfortable with people who are older than me, always have been. And so I was happy to, you know, I'd be down the market, you know, chatting to the older generation when the sons didn't have a clue who this kid was. So I had a friend of mine just rocked up eventually and was like, listen, this is how I met him. So look, you've been here a while now. Everyone's starting to think you're weird. Come and hang out with people your own age pretty well. So he took me down the local rugby club, and then, but I always find like, and I found it now because my fiance, she has moved into the area. We've got a house together and so on. And she's a vet in the area. And I've seen it again with her.
Okay.
Everyone's so friendly. There's not this, you know, Six Nations time, there may be a bit of a, wee, we've lost a one. But apart from that, the community, and that's why I like to look down this valley and I see all the people who have helped me. And I've probably, I know full well that I've annoyed people, I've made mistakes and I've done that, but they're just a fantastic people, you know, they've made the farming for me.
That's amazing. That's so good to hear. Mm. So that was, 9 years ago when you moved there?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Long time ago now.
9 years ago. So how has the farm changed from then to what it is now? What have you got going on there now?
So when we moved here, it was, you know, we came from Gloucester where it was all North Country mules, Suffolk Tups and Texels and stuff. So we tried that for the first year and realised that was wrong. And, you know, I think our first lambing season was that 2012-2013 winter, you know, with all the snow.
Oh, right. Oh, great. What a...
Yeah.
So, and like, welcome to Wales.
Oh, very much so. We only had half a shed. I was stupid. My system then was lamb early.
Yeah, okay.
So we ran a very intensive system. So we lambed everything indoors.
Yeah,
we ran mules and Texels and Beltex. I was attempting to breed pedigree Beltex. So I was never any good at it. I couldn't work out why they got stuck on their backs. And so we did all things like that. And then after 2013, we're like, right, okay, well, we clearly, some of the ground is not suited to these breeds.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going, well, let's just lamb later. It took me many years to learn that. It was like, no, let's get Cheviots. and I'm meticulous in my study. At school, I was rubbish at academics, but when it comes to farming, I will study and I will spend. I spent 12 months basically researching Cheviots.
I think that's quite a common story in farming, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I'm like a sheep nerd, and so I studied these Cheviots, and then I went and bought Cheviots basically, and we started to run like a. I tried to run the whole sheep. System, you know, the whole sheep pyramid, which I promised I wouldn't talk about, on one farm. So, you know, we had the Cheviot breeding the Cheviot mule, and the Cheviot Mule was breeding then with a Tex, Bell Tex and a Texel was breeding us a fat lamb.
Okay.
Bear in mind, this is 74 acres. So first things first, I had to learn that actually, you know, in Gloucester, where you could quite, you know, grass grows in February.
Yeah.
People turn their cattle out in March. If you don't get your crops sown, usually, you know, the farmers you tell me, you know, and I'm not an arable farmer, they should say if you don't get sown in by the end of March, beginning of April, you won't get it in because it'll go too dry.
Yeah.
We've gone from somewhere where droughts all the time to we get snow and rain on the regular. we get 5 foot of rain.
Yeah,
in general, a year. So as I say, we start to slowly phase out, but of the mules, and then we were renting pockets of ground everywhere. So I'd rent ground in, say, towards Newtown, which was a bit lower and better in the season. So then we'd run a mule flock there, and then we'd run a bit harder ground up the valley. So we'd run the Cheviots there, and then we'd breed the tups at home. And it was very complicated, very busy, and very easy for me to get wrong, because, you know, you have to, I remember, I still, as I say, don't know anything, but I knew very little, and I just had an idea of where I wanted to be, but didn't know how.
Yeah.
So after failing constantly for 9 years to achieve anything, you know, for some reason, our lambing percentage was going down. Lambs reared was going down. Just the health was not good. We were buying stock in left, right, and center, because I had this number in my head of 1,000 sheep. I forgot the fundamentals.
Okay.
I forgot the foundation stuff, you know. Right. And I was just young and ambitious and stupid and arrogant. And I was like, right, well, this is the direction I want to go.
Sure.
And so this is what I'm going to do, regardless of really looking at what the landscape can provide. So then it got to, and so we started to phase the mules out about 4 years ago. 4 years ago, something like that. We started to give up pockets of ground and try to rent ground closer or just make the ground that we had better. And then the Beast of the East hit, and it just kind of completely flipped everything on its head. And now we lamb in May. So, you know, we've completely changed the system. Beast of the East hit. And I'm not going to bring the podcast down because I'm laughing the whole time, but we lost 50 to 60% of our lambs. We lost about a good 600 lambs, something like that. And because we've invested heavily in the new system, but the new system being all Cheviots, you know, all Cheviot ewes, and as much at grass as possible, no longer using the lambing shed. But we still had mules, so we hadn't phased the old system out.
Sure. Okay.
The mules were in the shed. And we were still ambitious, thinking, right, okay, well, we could lamb these chivs at the end of March or middle of March. We can lamb them all outdoors and it'll be fine. What an idiot. So we lambed end of March, and then BC's hit, and we lost all these lambs and lost these ewes. But I invested about 80K in the autumn beforehand in ewes.
Okay.
Went out and bought a packet of 630 Cheviot ewes and various other things, just to basically build my number up, because we got some decent foundations. I mean, in the sense of, we had a landlord who didn't look like he was going anywhere. I still at this point knew nothing. And so we did all of that and thought, right, okay, well, this is great. So my brother-in-law helped me write the business plan, you know, absolute Excel nerd. And so did all that and got the funding. It was great. We're moving in a direction, and boom, in, you know, 24 hours, gone.
It's kind of the tale of farming in a way, isn't it? I guess it's always been like that. Those kind of, I suppose it's just the worry is that those what were once in a generation weather events are kind of happening much more frequently now.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. And so it made me basically after a 12-month tantrum that I'd lost all of them stock, I basically went, right, okay, this is it now, we're going aggressive. So we traveled to New Zealand, we traveled about Scotland, met with some great guys up in Scotland, and, you know, one farmer in particular really did open my eyes to how the possibilities of it, of a sheep system, and, you know, he's a really, really good guy. And then we went to New Zealand and just saw how they farm without support, how they farm, you know, and I just needed to go there to basically fall in love with farming again after the Beast of the East. And so went there and came back then with a complete, and it's completely the opposite of what we used to be. We no longer lamb inside the shed. This is why it's so wasteful. The most the shed gets is we store ewes in there from end of tupping in December to like the 17th of March.
Okay.
Just to get him off the ground, basically. Whereas this year we've now ventured in to root crops and stuff, so we're going to put them on there.
Okay.
We are fencing all the fields up into like 2 acre, 3 acre paddocks, so we are rotationally grazing as much as we can, and we're all one breed, all Cheviots, and Cheviots go to Cheviots, and a lot of people don't maybe not like them, but they make up for all the gaps that I have in my shepherding abilities and knowledge. We don't start lambing until the 25th of April, and we sell all of our lambs as store lambs.
Wow. Okay.
So we try and do it real simple, because I basically realized, basically, probably borrowed too much cash to build the business up, and now we're too top heavy after losing all the stock, you know, so we're having to build the stock up. So we've completely, we spent the whole of last year just stopping and working on our foundation. So I spent a lot, you know, vast amount of money, which you, in the grand scheme of things, you can't put a price on it. But I spent 12 months, I rang the vet and I said, look, there's too many gaps in my knowledge. I know what I know, you know what you know. I want to build my sheep image, and you tell me the science, basically, of what I've got to do. So we spent 12 months, we scanned for OPA, we blood tested for yonis, we went through, we worm sampled, we tested all of our drenches, and really just actually, what, instead of going out and buying more sheep and on this quest to have bigger numbers, we just found out about the ones we had.
Yeah.
And we worked out, sorry.
I think that's really interesting, because I guess it's just finding the system that works for your farm and your lifestyle, isn't it?
But
you've probably got to make those mistakes along the way, I think.
Yeah. A farmer told me that experience is expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to make those mistakes.
I think you've just given me the title of the show, of this episode.
There you go. So our system's completely different now. And you're right. It suits the lifestyle. Yeah. Cause I juggle everything. I'm probably stupidly ambitious. And so I want to do everything. I really do want to do everything. And for some reason, although I'm 27, I feel time is fleeting. So I've got that from my mum. She's like that. She's like, oh, I'm running out of time to do everything. And she's still on her quest to breed an Olympic show jumper. And I'm running out of time. So I think I'm like that. But what they're like, Richard always used to tell me, he's like, let's build a system to suit your farm.
Mm-hmm.
Don't look at my farm and try and build a system, you know, off of the back of that. You have to build a system to suit your farm. So I love Cheviots. I love them. They are fantastic. They are wild, you know, and they do all sorts of other things wrong, but they are a brilliant animal. And at the end of the day, when you're going around and it's rainy, they're a nice thing to look at.
Yeah.
I think you have to like what you're farming, don't you?
I totally agree.
And, you know, and it took Richard probably, I don't know, 6 years, but he finally got it knocked into my head that soil, you have to farm soil, be a soil farmer before you can be a livestock farmer. Mm-hmm. And I finally got that knocked into my head. So now we're just all, I'm trying to learn as quick as possible and ask as many questions and ask the people that know how much grass, you know, what grass we have to do. And then I speak to people endlessly about grass, which my fiance thinks I'm so boring. And so she's at risk of leaving me off grass chat. And we're trying to build a system that suits, as you say, what I do with everything else in my life. So yeah, we lamb late. And that's nice. You know, lambing end of April, beginning of May, there's not too much snow that time of year.
No.
And there's grass under the feet and you just see these lambs go in you can be in shorts and a t-shirt and you can sit and look at the romantic side of farming,
mm-hmm. which is important. It is important. 100%. It shouldn't be the be-all and end-all, but it is important, I think.
Yeah. Well, like I think as well, we have to remember why we do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much
and,
so, yeah.
And I don't think I haven't appreciated the journey I've been on so far. And I'm hoping now, like every day, I'm trying to appreciate the journey I'm on for the rest of my life. Hmm. And although there are some bloody sour days, there's some hard days, there's some crackers too. And I want to just like, sometimes I just like to sit up on the top of our place and just look down really and look at the landscape and just admire what we do. And like I was of that mindset when I was younger was don't talk too much about farming because it's not cool I don't want to be, I want to be a farmer, but I don't want to tell you I'm a farmer. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I'd shout it from the rooftops. The first thing I'd say is, you know, I don't want to make farming my identity, but it is. I live and breathe it. And although, you know, we live off the farm, and that was an attempt for me to try and separate the farm from me, because it overruns me. And so I can go home, and you can never turn a key, but I just think about it all the time. You know, I go on holiday and like, I'll probably sleep for the first 3 days. And after that, I'm like, right, I want to go farming.
So, tell us about the farm experience days that you're running there. I'm really interested in this.
I have credit to Becky, my fiance. She came up with this idea. It's an idea that came to us when we were in New Zealand. And it was so Becky is from Essex. She doesn't like me telling people that, but she's from Essex. and yes, she is blonde. She's a vet, and she didn't come into it conventionally.
Okay.
I don't think she imagined. I think when she started her vet degree, she didn't think there should be a mixed animal vet in Wales with a soon to be husband as a farmer. Like yesterday on a day off, she was helping me dip sheep.
Okay.
And she did it with a smile on her face.
Wow.
So I know. We're still young. So we were driving around, and as I say, neither of us had a conventional way into our industries. And we thought, well, there's too many people who miss out on opportunities because of they're either not in the right place or they haven't been exposed to the opportunity.
Yeah.
Or they didn't know. They like, you know, a lot of it is they just don't have that mentality. They're not in that zone where they think, well, actually it is an option. They could do it. Mm-hmm. So we came originally, it's a pre-vet course is the core of it. And it's something we haven't started too long ago, but so we do a 2-day course, and we price it so that we don't price people out.
Sure.
We don't price those people out who parents maybe you have to do things on a budget.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we are extremely lucky that we live in this landscape. Well, we want people to also have a go. So what we do is we do a 2-day course, but it's a 2-day crash course, and it's everything you have to do for work experience to get into vet school. Okay. And we've had people from Canada, centre of London,
wow,
all sorts. So that they come for 2 days and they do a fully hands-on, you know, if you don't leave with mud under your fingernails, you've not tried hard enough. So they start, you know, it depends on what we're doing, but they do dairy. So they go to Llysin.
Okay.
And Morgan Tudor this year was a fantastic, what an asset that guy is. You know, he worked with these, you know, he's only 18 himself, but the students left inspired. So that's what we try and do. We try and put them in front of inspirational people who are, who aren't afraid to ask for help, but who are, you know, toeing the line. So, and then they have to come to me, which is the downfall. But so we'll do sheep, we do dairy, we do sheep, we do horses, and we do pigs and chickens.
Okay.
We do cows and so on. So that's everything they need really to have an interesting conversation when they do their interviews to get to vet school, when they have to have their experience. So it also leads to, we help them then gain access to farms, because farmers are a little bit more, they're more at ease when they know that they've been on a farm before, because you know what it's like. If you're standing in the wrong place when you're moving cows, you can ruin the whole eating test. You know, I'm sure you would have had it. Why are you stood there?
I still get it now, and I'm 42. I'm with my dad.
There you go, exactly. It's always the why you stood there. So we do that. So, you know, like mum does the stud and the horse stuff. So you're working with people who universities have to pay a lot of money to get, but they're getting it at a decent price that makes it affordable. So we do all those sorts of things, but then we're teeing off it now. So we are trying to do an armed forces one. So with my brother, but that's probably based more at the parents. So it's for 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds. That's usually who we're getting at. We're getting at these people who need reassurance that option is for them, so they don't come and run the 30 miler with Dan because he can't do that but they just like do a few things that may trip them up, and they can just dip their toe into a world without committing their whole life.
Are you getting good feedback from it?
We are, believe it or not, we are like like the reviews are unreal, and we're changing all the time to trying to develop it so it's better for teaching. But yes, it's great. We have people emailing up for emailing to come next year, but they like last year that everyone's, it's snowballing now. It really is, like everyone's starting to they're starting to book a year in advance, and we're having to put more courses on, and you know we're helping them all with the references and stuff. But then I think the icing on the cake for us is So we, for Welsh students, because there's a serious lack of Welsh like vets and mm-hmm. things like that, we offer a 10% discount for it on the CERN network.
Okay.
Which is part of the school system. So we work with an amazing lady called Jane Bevan, and she basically points all these guys now, and we offer them a 10% discount just to try and show that, you know, I don't care if you were from the center of Cardiff or if you live up in Snowdonia, you've always got an option to do whatever you want to do. Anything is possible. Work out your plan, where point B is, and then we'll work out where we have to go. So we work with them, and the Welsh government now have gone, look, can you make two inspirational videos for year 12s and 13s and 10s and 11s.
That's so cool. Brilliant.
And one is vet specific and one is animals. So like that's why I've been with Thea. So we've traveled about Wales and met these fantastic people. So we've done interviews with vets, and to find out that you know, a lot of them are like, we didn't come from an all, like, you know, what you call a conventional background, you know. And we had which was great for us, is we had an old boy on there. He, believe it or not, is at the end of his veterinary career, but he doesn't want to let go. He's like, I don't want to go home. so he's still going, but he loves his craft. He loves his trade, which is fantastic. And he was like, look, you don't need to be a farmer to be a vet. You don't need to be a farmer to be a farmer. You just need to be hardworking and willing to give everything a go. And I think that's a message that we need to send. But yes, we do all these great, great, great courses, and these videos. Oh, I'm looking forward to watching them. Yeah, they are. We work with great crew as well. So brilliant. So yeah, that's that. So we've diversified into that basically, just to try and offer experiences. You know, there's other things we're doing. We'll do equine courses. We've done stud medicine. We're starting to work with like veterinary nurses, because they often get forgotten about. I don't know, mm-hmm. you know, Becky knows more than me. And we're trying to just give everyone an opportunity. And what as well is good is people come and they go, right, actually it's not for me.
Okay.
We've saved them there.
Which is just as valuable, isn't it?
Isn't it just?
Yeah.
We've had people who go, actually, no, herding sheep in the rain is not for me. So that's what we've done with that.
Brilliant. Do you think there's an opportunity for other farmers to get involved with that kind of thing? We're sort of like for a long time we've kind of almost put up a wall around our farms in a way, haven't we? And sort of not wanting to connect with the public. But again, mentioning coronavirus, you know, people wanting to get out into nature, you know, we've seen people using footpaths a lot more and getting out and about. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is an opportunity there for us as an industry to connect with the people? And we, you know, we talk about telling people what we do and about where the food comes from and things. I mean, that's it, all connects into that, doesn't it?
I 100%. I think there is a fantastic opportunity going forward now to offer. Like, I don't mean open the floodgates so, you know, everyone can trample on our green fields, but no. I mean, yeah, you know, like ring any farmer can ring a university, email a university, and say, look, we do lamb. This is when we lamb. Can we be of any assistance? Mm-hmm. You know, because it's helped me so much. It's grown me as a person to help students. So one of the best students I had was a vegan, and what a fantastic girl she was. She was brilliant. She got involved with everything, and she was, you know, really understanding and really. And she left, you know, still, you know, her beliefs were her beliefs, and that's fine. You know, there's we want to show that we're not, you know, we're not tarnishing her with a brush or whatever. She was fantastic, but she left understanding why we do it and what we do, and we understood leaving why we should. But yeah, any farmer can get involved. You know, ring the NFU and say that you want to take students on, or ring the vet colleges, ring Liverpool, ring the RBC of London, ring them all and give them an email and just say, look, and they'll put you on a list, and then you'll get an email, probably get 10 or 15 different students, and you just choose how many you need. And then that's it. You can open your doors, and once you've done it once and you've had them there, and you've realized that, wow, there's some of them come from America, some of them from all parts of the world. And you really do realize that actually what we've got, we're very blessed, and we should indeed be just show off what we do.
Mm. You Fantastic. Know? So you have got involved with quite a few wider industry roles. When as a sort of new entrant coming into farming, I guess it would be quite easy to just sort of get your head down, concentrate on your own business, and kind of not pay attention to all that. So why did you choose to do that?
Education, I would say. I think, yeah, I wanted to, I don't know, I idolized to say, I've spoken about him quite a lot. I idolized Richard Tudor quite a lot. So like, I want to do what he does. But yeah. But no, I, education. There's a massive gap in my huge gap in my knowledge of basic things, and I wanted further understanding. I didn't just want to be someone who bitched and moaned and went, oh well, you know, this is not being done, without understanding actually how it has to be done.
Farmers don't do that. Do that, Mark.
No, isn't that why markets were built? So we could all moan. No, that's it, exactly. I wanted to learn, but I think as well, I've always felt like I've out of my depth. So, you know, like I've sat in a meeting with you and then you were talking. I was like, I am not meant to be here.
You must have got me mixed up with someone else.
No, I was like, my God, like, you've come research. People have brought pens. I haven't even brought a pen. What's going on? You know, I'm like, miss, can I have a pen? I'm not at school. I can't call a miss. So it's a massive, massive crisis. But no, I wanted to try and, whilst I was still maybe that younger person who was trying to work out how to get to the next step.
And
I still had an understanding. I wanted to try and get involved to learn, maybe on a selfish reason, forward my own career. Mm-hmm. But as well, maybe I could actually, hang on, could I, at 25, 26 or whatever, could I influence something that helps someone who's then like younger than me?
Yeah,
sure. Is what I thought, because that's really what I wanted to get into it. I wanted just to see what it's all about, and I wanted to try and actually help if I could. I think I've spent, you know, the NFU have probably spent a lot of time just trying to educate me, if I'm honest, into the real world. But now you can see our industry in a whole bigger picture.
Yeah.
It's not just it rains, it snows, it's hot, it's sunny, you grow grass, you try and make a product. It's not that. It's so much more. You know, we as farmers, we have a massive part to play in the whole cycle of the earth, I would say, like of the whole world. Like, we are, like I say, I'm not very articulate, I'm not putting it in a very good way, but like, what, you know, we're a tradable commodity, aren't we? So we, you know, that's why. So I've gone down an avenue where I'm still out of my depth. You know, I'm very lucky to be on the livestock board for NFU Cymru Livestock Board. And I have been sent to numerous, you know, Welsh council meetings, and I'm on next generation boards as are you, and do all sorts of things like that. And I just find myself constantly trying out my depth. But I come away and I look at my farm in a different perspective.
I think everybody probably feels out of their depth at these things, Tom, because, you know, everyone has a little bit of imposter syndrome, don't they? But I think one of the big things for me about that, and I sort of started looking at wider industry much later in life. When I was younger, I just wasn't that aware of it. But as I've got older, I've realised how important it is to try and sort of give something back to the industry if you can. But one of the things that I've most got out of that, especially the next gen group, which obviously is a range of farmers of different ages from all over Wales, is that I just find them all so inspiring in different ways. And, you know, looking at what they're doing with their business, and they're all from different backgrounds and different kind of farms and things like that. And it just sort of opens your mind, I think, a bit, because there's a danger of, especially at a time like this, you just get stuck on your own farm, don't you? And you forget there is this whole wider industry out there and lots of amazing people.
That's it, 100%. You know, and meeting, I think as well, like rubbing shoulders with people like yourself and Clea and the Preds of the world, and things like these ambitious people who it's not conventional. Like, you know, I listen, because you're a tenant farmer, listening to the fact that you're making a success of it and you're doing all of this, and you're then creating a future for your family and stuff. I think, well, actually, you know, you can get there. And then, you know, and Clea speaks so openly, probably too open at times, and you think, well, actually, well, hang on, that's what I wanted. I wanted to surround myself with honest people who are open. You know, like, I'm probably too open about, if I'm having a hard time, I'll try and talk about it, because, you know, like, I'll bombard Clea, I bombard Richard, I'll speak to Pred or whatever, and I'll speak to these people, and I'm like, right, well, this is going wrong, I've borrowed this much money, and all this is going pear-shaped, and then they'll come through with their honesty.
Sure.
And you go, well, actually, hang on, you're not alone, because that's, as you say, you can feel very isolated. But then to go to these meetings and to talk to these people and then hear their honesty, and then all sit together and go, right, okay, well, how can we prevent this from happening to someone else, or how can we get the message across that this is what we do? I feel very inspired, and I'm very lucky to be to get onto the boards and stuff that I do. And I hope that I can continue on, really.
Okay, so sort of moving on from that then a bit about perhaps talking about your problems, which is something that we've traditionally not been very good at as an industry.
Segue.
Yeah. So that is what they call in the business a segue, Matt.
Yeah, nice.
How did you ever get to the point where you decided to climb 9 mountains in 72 hours to raise money for the DPJ Foundation?
It all goes back. Like, I think as a personality, I've always been like, it started with rugby and then it's come to farming. I always dabbled in depression, shall we say. I was always in my own head, and instead of looking at what I had achieved, always looking at what I hadn't achieved. And I was basically, no one could make me more miserable than me.
You know? yes, me too. I'm exactly the same.
Isn't it? Yeah. You know, and it's there's nothing more lonely than being in that position. So it just came to a head, I think, after, you know, my farming career, I liken to pushing a stone uphill, right? And okay. I'm pushing this big stone, working hard, getting tired. And I'm always getting to that point, and then someone is coming like, just come pushes me back, or the stone breaks, or the hill gets bigger, or something like that. So, but the Beast of the East came, and I lost all of that money, and I'm paying for the Beast of the East now for the next 20 years of my life. Mm-hmm. I lost that money, I lost that stock, and I've always been like the stock, because I've had to work so hard to get each individual animal. I always took it quite hard.
Sure.
You know, like, so the Beast of the East, I had 5 students there, and you just had to function, basically. And it was so hard. It was life and death. And so many farmers went through it.
Yeah.
But it just knocked me for 6. So I was numb for about, I don't know, I was numb till, because and until I don't know June, July, and I was just numb. But then there was just a change of it. I was just miserable. I didn't want to farm anymore, because every time I went out, I'd look at the scars. The fields, we went into a massive drought, but the fields were starting to green up, and it was dry, it was warm, but I could still see the lambs that weren't there. Every time I got the sheep in, there was 600 lambs missing. Yeah. There were breeding ewes that were, we knew that we were just, I was just keeping them on because I wanted them to have a quality of life before then they had to go, because they wouldn't do another season. You know, these are yearly ewes that had been damaged by the snow or whatever. And so in that, you have a form of, I don't know, PTSD or whatever, but I just kind of lived in that headspace, and I was miserable. So I reached a point. So we went, that's the point at which I said, right, we've got to do something different. And I went to New Zealand, and I kind of, in New Zealand, I was there, and you always think that you're getting better and you're getting better and you're getting better, but like, I'm still getting better now. I've basically got to New Zealand. And I was like, I still hated farming. I was like, I didn't want to be here. I was like going on lambing beats, and I wasn't fussed. I wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. I couldn't bother with the cold. I was like, oh, I'm done with this. And that made it worse.
Yeah.
But then one day I just basically cracked and started speaking to, I was with a guy called Ross Patterson, who was a brilliant bloke, like really, really good guy. And I just started basically talking at him, the poor guy. And he then started, you know, talking back to me, and we just started this conversation, and we had a bit of reassurance, and we had an honest conversation.
Yeah.
And I kind of came back refreshed. I was like, boom, right, I want to be a farmer again. I'm keen, and got into it. And then I started to do all these different things about, you know, mental health and stuff. And I thought, right, okay, well, I'm going to draw a line to this. This is where I stop. Because the last hardest thing I did was work, you know, all night and all day in those snowstorms. That was the last most difficult thing I did. And I don't just mean physically, I mean mentally, you know, digging sheep up to find that they'd half lambed, and you know, I'm not going to get too graphic, and crows had really picked them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And to deal with that death and devastation, that was the last hardest thing I do. Right. Okay. Well, before we can carry on with the rest of our life, I'm going to put something down. That's going to be the hardest thing I've ever done.
Okay.
And the Beast of the East is not even going to touch it.
Yeah.
So I was sat at, I think I was either, there's one or two places, I can't really remember, but it was more likely in the pub. But I was either in the pub or I was having a cup of tea, and I was with my brother-in-law, and I said, right, I'm going to do something really hard. And he was like, well, why don't you do the 3 peaks? I was like, yeah, I want to do the 3 peaks. Yeah, that's great. Well, actually, hang on. What about if we do 3 peaks in every country? And he was like, all right, okay. I was like, but what if we do 3 peaks? Because it's like 3 peaks in 24 hours. What if we do 9 peaks in 72 hours? So you get, you know, a day to clear them all near enough.
Yeah.
And he was like, right, well, has anyone done it before? So we started to research it, and no one had done it that we were aware of. People had probably done it, but we were aware of. No one had basically hounded marketing as hard as we had anyway. So we did all of that. And then we went, right, okay, well, let's set a date. And then so I rang the NFU and I was like, right, I'm going to do this. But I want a charity. I don't know who to do it for. Because originally it was just going to be me and my brother-in-law, and we were going to go for a walk. And I didn't care. It wasn't for anyone else. It wasn't for that. It was for me. I was going to go and do something really difficult. And I was going to clear, I was going to rid myself, and I was going to set a new bar. Mm-hmm. And so around, eventually, like, I think it got to about March, and I started to work out what we're going to have to do. And I was like, actually, I think we need to do this for a charity. I think I'm going to need some G-ing on. I need to put myself in a position where I could not do it. I rang the NFU when I spoke to Bronwyn, and she was like, well, you know, the DPJ is this new up and coming charity that told me the story, and they told me what was, you know, why it was founded and so on. I was like, right, that's the one. That's the one we're doing it for. Because I didn't just want to do it and then, I don't know, give the money to a very wealthy charity. Because at this point, I didn't know how much money would raise, but I wanted to, I'm not taking away from all of the charities, I wanted to do something close to my heart. And I found out about this and I was like, right. And then I messaged Emma on via email or something like that. And she told me later on down the line, she saw it. She was like, yeah, we get like 10 of these a year. Someone's going to do something for us. Yeah, great. That's fantastic. But will it happen?
Yeah.
And then I rang her eventually. I was like, by the way, I just thought I'd better meet you. Because I think it got to like 6 months in or 3 months in or something like that, and it was like I hadn't actually spoke to her yet.
Yeah.
And so I was like, right, I thought I'd just better ring you. And then I spoke to her. What a fantastic person she is.
She's brilliant. Yeah,
like what an inspiring individual. And just like, and she's helped me no end. She really has helped me no end. And what a fantastic, that's just a brilliant person. Like, yeah, I can't recommend it higher. So I spoke to her, and she's a bit like me, a bit eccentric, and, you know, ambitious and fast, probably fast speaking.
Gets things done. That's what we're talking about.
Gets things done. That's exactly. Yeah. And she's comfortable swearing a lot. So, doesn't make me feel so bad. So we started to snowball. We started to drag people in. So we spoke to the NFU, and the NFU were great. Like Dan at the NFU was like, this is mental, but I'm definitely back in this. And he wanted to, he did want to have a go. So we just got into it really. And then, so we started to pull in other people. We started to pull in a lad called Gareth Owen, who's local here. He's got a computer for a brain, and so he worked out all the logistics. So he was a driver and worked out all the logistics, and he worked out like when we'll be done and how it'll be done. Because apparently you can't go and climb 9 of the UK's highest mountains in 72 hours with a like ham sandwich and a cup of tea. So we thought, right, okay, well, actually we need someone like my brother-in-law. He works in London. You know, he's got clean hands, shall we say. You know, clean hands and good nails. But he just says yes to anything. So I thought, right, we need someone actually knows anything, because I don't know anything. Like, I will. So I rang my brother. So I was like, Dan, do you want to come do this 9 picks? Like, yeah, all right. So it got him involved. And then boom, there was three of us. There was the three walking party. And then there was Gareth, who was basically our babysitter and in charge of all the logistics and stuff.
Okay.
And then with that, Dan then rang Land Rover and was like, look, we're doing this. So then they gave us a disco, all like sign written up, and it was all kitted out, and it was amazing. It stank by the end time we'd finished. And so like this little thing that I'd come up with having a cup of tea, and I just wanted to challenge myself, it grown into something bigger.
Yeah.
And I, Emma tells me what it means. Like I'm still someone who doesn't appreciate what we've done really, because I really, I don't know. I don't want to stop and talk about what we've done, just in case someone thinks I'm arrogant.
How much money did you raise in the end?
Oh, well over 12 grand.
Wow.
You know, well over 12 grand. And we did it. It was some hairy, you know, there were some hairy moments, but I think my knees have just stopped being swollen.
What was it like doing, by the third day, or the second night maybe, when you're sort of going up in the dark or coming down in the dark, what was that like? Was it quite, did you start to see things, or was it?
Yeah. So like I always thought that by the third day was when my knees and ankles are gone, but it was by the second day.
Okay.
So just imagine, so we climbed Ben Nevis at like 7 o'clock at night. And he'd given us 8 hours to do that. We did it in 5 just because it was the first one and we were excited. Okay. and we carried far too much kit. And then, you know, by day two, we climbed the second mountain through the night. And then we got back and we managed to do it quick enough that we were allowed some sleep time.
Okay.
So we managed to get about 25 minutes or something of sleep, undisturbed sleep. So Daniel slept because as being an ex-Royal Marine, you just put your sleeping bag in a car park or a ski lodge and slept. Whereas I slept upright in a car with loads of stuff around me. And so we all had tried to have a sleep and get much food on and stuff. And then we were like, right, okay, well, let's go to the next mountain. So Gareth was like, oh, well, you know, don't get too comfortable. It's not far away. It was 15 minutes. So we went and did that. So then by day two, things were getting hard.
Yeah.
But I remember speaking to my dad before I went. I was like, shit, Dad, is this possible?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's going to have to be now, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He basically said, look, the only way, he's always told me in life, the only way you won't get somewhere is if you stop. So we always said, so my auntie lives in Cumbria, and she's like, if you could walk to Auntie Elaine's house, your shoes will get worn out, you'll get tired, but the only way you won't get there is if you stop.
Yeah, yeah.
He basically said, don't stop. Don't stop and don't die.
sound advice, Dad.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. So we trundled on, but it was by day two, we were in bits. You know, I think of the whole 3 days, Gareth reckons, because he recorded all of it like on GoPros, that we only had 45 minutes undisturbed sleep.
Wow.
And we did 71 miles of walking over a thousand miles of driving or something. So, you know, because you're in the car, but you're in the car. And although discos are very nice and we thank Land Rover, but we're all quite tall. So it wasn't, and we had so much stuff in there. It was tight. So you were uncomfortable. So by the end, we were all limping. What my brother didn't tell us was on mountain number three, he's actually got a heart condition. He didn't tell us that.
Okay.
So he was very pale. But no, yeah, it was just, I think, you just go into a state, and this is where I tie it back to my parents and my upbringing. You go into a state of, well, one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
You just keep going, regardless of how painful it is. You have to keep going. You cannot stop. So, you know, it took us, by the time we got into Wales, Snowdonia was amazing. So we got into Snowdonia. We started climbing Snowdonia 10 o'clock on a beautiful June evening. And we thought, this is going to be fantastic. Got around the first corner, rain, hail. like I'm talking mist. You couldn't see anything. We were 3 hours late coming off it because we just couldn't see. Jeez. And we had a guy come from Anglesey, came down, a farmer came from Anglesey, and a guy came up from Gloucester and did it. And you know, we came down 3 o'clock in the morning and we were wet and miserable. But we really locked in as a team. And that's when it started to cement our relationships.
Yeah,
you know, we really start to realize that actually, well, this is our agricultural industry, the whole thing, we're all there together. Mm-hmm. So we came down and then we got to Cad Idris. Well, then the crowd started to grow. We had people who had driven up through the night from Gloucester, one of the sponsors, David Redford, he drove up. We had people from, we had 9 or 10 people. We had one guy who turned up, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, but he turned up to walk it, and it was the anniversary. It was his dad's birthday, and his dad sadly took his life.
Okay.
So it was quite poignant. So we started to build this momentum, and then we got down to Penavan, and wow, then the floodgates opened. There were 60, 70 people.
Wow.
And 60, 70 people climbed Penavan, which you'll know yourself, isn't a massive walk.
Yeah.
And we climbed it, and we're all in bits at this point. Like, I don't even have a rucksack on anymore. I don't care. I'm wearing, you know, we're like, our feet are torn apart, and I couldn't bend my legs and whatever, but we're all in bits. But then there's 60, 70 people come from all over the UK, not just Wales. And they'd come and it was fantastic. And it carried us over. Amazing. You know, like I can never explain to you what it felt like, because there were bits that were horrible, and there were bits like, why, like my brother was like, I've been a Marine, what have I got to prove? why am I doing this? You know, George's feet were falling off, and his hips, and my sister turned up in Cumbria because we were in such a bad way. Like, you know, we're having chili con carne out because the Royal Marines gave us ration packs.
Okay.
So we were having like a chicken con carne or a chili con carne for breakfast at 4 a.m. But my sister turned up and did some, like, tried to strap us all up, and she put an acupuncture needle in my leg, and it was bouncing as if someone was on the end of it, twisting it.
Oh, man. Okay.
Just because we were all so tight, and every step was like, it was a stone in your shoe, you know?
Yeah.
But we just kept on going, and it just, and I just revert back to, that is the hardest thing I've done so far in life. And that is, that's my limit. So when I'm tired and when I don't want to do something, or where I don't want to give someone the time that they deserve, I'm like, well, actually, hang on, come on, we've done this. This is the hardest thing we've done. We can keep going a little bit longer. And it sounds maybe a bit emotional, but that genuinely was the best things I've ever done in my entire life, for the best charity I've ever come across. And I've made friends. And growing up, because of the way our family worked, you know, dad working away and mum working full time, you know, we were a massive, very, very tight family, for better or worse, hugely tight. And I always look at my friends as family. I bring people in too quick, but they're family. But those people at the DPJ and everyone that we work with and work with, they are family for life. And anything, if they need me at a drop of the hat, I'll be there. But I'm ruined from it, but what a fantastic, fantastic trip. And it was just like, for a while, it was just like going on stag do. No alcohol.
Yeah, different 20 stag do I've been on, I know what you mean. Fantastic. All right then, Matt, let's start to wrap this up with the 5 quick questions, if you're ready.
Whenever you are.
What's your all-time favourite song?
Oh, see, I saw this, and I love music, but my music spectrum is weird, so it depends on what mood I'm in.
It changes all the time, doesn't it? I know, it's quite a difficult question, I think.
It does. I don't know. That's a real hard one. I'm going to go safe, because I like that. Bass Hunter's quite entertaining to me, but I will go Mumford Sons, Little Iron Man.
Okay.
I was going to go, I could go old school, like Motown. I love Motown, but no.
Yeah, I love Motown. What's your favorite Motown song? Should have asked you that.
Yeah, you should have asked me that. Like, I love, my dad used to make me listen to it all the time, but I love like Heard It Through the Grapevine and things like that. I love that on vinyl.
Oh man. Brilliant. That bass line. What TV show would you most like to star in?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't know. Is it TV show or like reality TV show, or what is it?
Either, whichever.
I wouldn't mind a punt at SES Who Dares Wins.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Just that'd be quite cool, but I don't know, really. I'm probably not interested enough to be on TV.
If you were ruler of the world, who would you appoint to be your top advisor?
Ruler of the world.
Yeah. Who would be your Dominic Cummings?
Oh, I don't know. Jeremy Clarkson's quite a good laugh. I don't know. He'll probably say, "What? Why am I so weird for saying this?" But I don't know. I reckon Shea Jones, he'd do a good job.
Yeah.
Or I would appoint like a friend of mine, Fred, but he's just done like people. So, but I'll say like this would be Jeremy Clarkson or Shea.
Okay. What's your favourite Welsh rugby victory over England, Matt?
Oh, see, I thought about this. I did think about this. Now, I'm fickle. I don't really support teams. I just love watching rugby.
Okay.
But it'll be, I've been to more live, I never watch England live, apart from if I was there as a Welsh fan.
Okay.
So it'll probably be one of their last Grand Slam victories or something like that. You know, when like England are on the pit and they're going to win it, and then the Welsh team just carried on the passion of a whole country. They just nail it in the bag in the last like 2-3 minutes. That they are my favourite victories, because that is what Wales is good at. You can never like turn your back on them.
No, I agree. It's the World Cup one for me. The World Cup. It's the World Cup quarterfinal. I sprained my ankle celebrating it because I jumped so high off the bar stool I was sitting on in a pub when. Anyway, lastly, then, what's your favourite agricultural related social media account to follow?
I'm not going to give you an easy answer for anything, if I'm honest. You probably want to wrap this up. But I like to follow people who are honest and are on the journey. I don't like just to look at pretty farms, because that makes me feel terrible. you know, I want someone to go, right, okay, you know, I like to follow someone who is inspiring, you know, like the Ridian Glynns of the world. They are growing all this grass, but he's also like, you know, bad day, this has gone wrong. because it shows. So I can't give anyone, like, as I say, I like to follow him. I like to follow Tom Jones Pentry at Bias, just because he heckles me all the time and it really cheers me up. But like people like you know, the Ross Pattersons, the people who are, you know, like yourselves, I can't give anyone an answer. I have tried, and it's a rubbish way of ending it. But anyone who really is on that journey, who's honest and who's just showing it for what it is, but showing them for what they are and showing what's going on for what it is, they're the people I love to follow. But yeah, I'd be amiss if I didn't say Tom Jones, because he does heckle me for being Adam Henson's son all the time. But that's what I want. I like that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, he could ring me and do it, but publicly it's far more funny.
Matt, it's been great to speak to you finally, because we have had to rearrange this a few times. So
yeah, it's all right. I'll blame you.
No, brilliant to hear more about your journey and everything you've done. I think you're probably quite inspiring to other new entrants. You've talked about other people inspiring you, but I think people listening who are looking for a way into farming, I think they could take quite a lot of inspiration from your journey, I think.
Well, if they if anyone, like, all I say is that anyone ever needs to have a chat about it or come up with some ideas, or realistically, I can just point them in the direction of someone who does know. Mm-hmm. Anything like that, like, I'm always open to it. If there's, I'm you know, I am where I am, and only on the bottom rung of the ladder, may I say, because of the people around me. It's the people who have made me want to be or try to be where I'm going. So I truly believe that that's the way that we should carry on as an industry. We should be helping and supporting everyone. So if anyone needs me to point them in the direction of someone, just, you know, give us a message on Twitter or whatever, or if anyone needs anything like that, then I'm always open for a conversation.
Brilliant. Matt, it's been great. Hopefully catch up with you soon.
Yeah, definitely. Cheers, Will.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.